It's Wednesday, September 3rd, 2008, and you're listening to episode 114 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 6 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
My name's Pat.
My name is Chris, and I sound delicious.
We hope, because this is going to be a Chris-heavy episode, and now that your compressor is hopefully finally working, we'll be getting Chris an all-new medium-fi sound.
All-nude Chris?
All-nude, that's right.
It's hi-fi, solid-state Chris is what it is. And of course, I picked the perfect week because I have a little bit of a cold, so this is wonderful.
So it'll still
sound crappy.
Yeah, it's going to sound like garbage, yeah. No kidding. Yeah.
We had just one announcement today, and it's a big one. Worldwide Wing Night 5. Our first worldwide wing banquet night. Here's the deal. When I went out to start setting this up, I had trouble finding two things. Actually, I had trouble finding one thing, which was a room. But I had trouble finding a room that would hold the number of people we needed, would be secluded, so we're not dealing with passing throngs of obnoxious cover bands, and was actually available at the time we wanted. Really could not do it. What I ended up doing was I had to get us a small banquet hall at the restaurant we used for Worldwide Wing Night 3. So we are back at Cyberg's off of Dorset, which is World War II Wing Nights ago. It was a great place. Worked out really well, but we are not going to be in the room we had before. We're going to be at a nice white tablecloth banquet hall. It's going to look like something straight out of a wedding reception.
Except that it'll be a worldwide podcasting holiday with beer and wings and more beer and more wings.
Instead of mustacholi, there's going to be a line where they're going to have beer wings. And I'm not joking. It is seriously a catered banquet hall with beer and wings.
So okay, I have a question.
Go ahead.
All right. So if it's a bridal-like thing, will there be like separate tables, and then will someone be sitting at the loser table that has to go last because they're sitting too far from the bridal table?
You know, we should set up a head table. I tell you what, Chris, we will set up a head table, but it will only be used if you show up. If not, we're gonna leave it empty, kind of like just pouring one out for all our Chris's going up the river.
Oh man, you have no idea the amount of pressure now you've just put on me. That's November. That's November sweeps, man.
Let me put worse pressure on you. If you're not there, we're gonna call you up and have everyone sing that song again.
Oh my gosh! Actually, that was very enjoyable last time.
This room is capable of holding up to 100 people. I know last time we broke 50. Yeah. So come out to this one. You're not going to want to miss it. We've had a ton of fun at these things in the past. Also, we have enough time since it's 2 months in advance. First off, I am throwing down the challenge. Somewhere along the way, somebody said that the DLI guys drank us under the table.
Oh,
so I am throwing it down right now. DLI guys, if you are listening, you come to this Worldwide Wing Night.
We have been trying to get...
We will let you sit at the head table with Chris, and John will drink you under the table.
We have been trying to get Missouri or any podcasters to come out to a Worldwide Wing Night, because we don't want this to be a Fear the Boot holiday. This is a world holiday.
Right, absolutely. That's also why
the Missouri podcasters, they're all afraid.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
But you know what? Trampas, Dragonlance Canical, we got the guys down from Bear Swarm, the Role Playing Public Radio, anyone that's in the area, come on out, join us here in St. Louis. If you are not in St. Louis, I'm going to send some stuff out to the other podcasters. As Chad said, from the very start, this was supposed to be a gaming holiday. We just never got around to promoting it right. This time, I'm going to promote it right. We're going to make it a gaming holiday, so be sure to check the show notes. Do not miss this. One last big request, please bring cash. Because the room, they're charging us several hundred.
Lots of singles. Chris is going to be stripping.
Yes.
Rock on.
You know, the DLI guys, actually, they still have some of my laundry, and I do need to get that back.
I know. They actually just posted something on their site saying they've been gone for a while, and it's not because they were doing our laundry. And believe me, I know. This is like the third week I've had to wear these pants. So, but please, if you're coming, and I hope you are, please do bring cash, because otherwise, they're going to give us one check, because this could potentially be up to 100 people. And you know how it goes. Somebody always ends up getting shafted because everyone ate $10 of food and only brought $5. And so some poor guy ends up carrying a massive amount of money. So please bring cash. They're not going to split these checks up. They're not going to give us separate checks. So bring cash for this. You've got 2 months to go to buy an ATM. So
it's way too many dishes to wash.
If you can't make it out to St. Louis for the 5th annual Worldwide Wing Night gaming podcast holiday, then have a wing night in your hometown. Come to our forums, and then there's a hookup thread where people from different cities and stuff are hooking up for games and whatnot. Hook up with some people around your city. Call your friends, call your family, whatever, and have some beer and wings. Raise a glass to this great holiday, and then take some pictures. And send those pictures to us, either email them or send them, you know, come and post them on our forums, and we're going to do a whole thread of worldwide wing night holiday pictures.
You know, we play up that Chris is sick this episode, and Pat's the one sitting over there snorting. So
I'm just hiding my snorting.
I'm trying my best to keep it off the mic. But it's
This is the first worldwide podcasting cocaine addiction intervention.
Nice.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to get that stuff out to the other podcasters. Everyone, once again, let's check this out and make it a success. Let's now get down to some Chris action. Chris,
well, you know, if I go, I mean, if I actually do show up, I'm going to probably have to bring my wife because she hasn't met you or your hair yet. So and she's expressed, you know, a great interest in seeing that.
Chris, you bring your wife, cigars for all.
Oh, really?
Well, not all the people, cigars for you. Let me amend that before I have to buy $500 worth of cigars. Cigars for you and your wife and probably cigar smoker when he comes up. I'm sure I owe him a few sticks.
Chad, if you could, actually, my wife just walked by and she heard the comment about the cigars. If you can light it as cool as you did when we were at Gen Con, that would probably be worth the price of admission right there.
Let me
just tell you, Chad has the style when it comes to lighting cigars. It's amazing. It's like he goes through this ritual, and he has this miniature butane torch that he uses to light these cigars. And he has just this certain style and motions and everything. And it's like a miniature art form for Chad.
You missed it. Me and Dan and John went out to a local bar called the Scottish Arms a few days ago. I'm sure everyone is real interested in that. But anyway, we went to the bar, and my butane torch lighter ran out of fuel. Couldn't light the cigars, and so I had to do the gold thing where I light up an entire book of matches to light one cigar, and it's like a big fire hazard. It's really cool. But
is also cool.
You know what I was actually thinking? Because we're going to have a worldwide wing night before Fear the Con, the night before Fear the Con. Because we used that last time, we used it as a big social mixer, and people set up games. It was really great. And what I was thinking about doing was having an event that people signed up for Fear the Con Worldwide Wing Night, and you pay like $5 to get into it, and I'll take all the money that people pay in, and I'll buy cigars, and I'll have a cigar lighting, selecting, and smoking class at that Worldwide Wing Night.
That would be amusing.
That would be very cool.
I definitely want to have that. I wish we could have had this Worldwide Wing Night a little bit earlier so it wasn't so close to Fear the Con, but I want to have it anyway just because, you know, a lot of people have been asking about this and I want to have one, but I don't want to drop the one near Fear the Con because it was too important of a social mixer. I think, and other people have said, that a large degree of the success of Fear the Con was because of that World Wing Night.
Everyone got liquored up the night before, and it was impossible to embarrass yourself the day after.
The ice was already broken. A lot of people already knew each other. Mm-hmm. So when they came in, it just felt like the continuation of the party the night before, except we moved from having beer and wings to having beer and role-playing games.
Exactly.
So, but I do still want to keep this one, so do everything you can to come out to this, because I think it's going to be great, and it's just going to be trippy having a banquet Worldwide Wing Night.
Yeah.
This is actually very cool.
It's like getting a 5-star grilled cheese sandwich. It just doesn't make any sense. All righty, Chris, let's talk about your GMing style. Where do you want to start?
Nervous. He opens up a module and he reads it verbatim, even the copyright.
All my campaigns have started off with "It's a dark and stormy night."
Okay.
No. Where do I start?
Speaking of campaigns starting off the same way, our movies will never begin again with "In a World Where."
I know. Everyone Don LaFontaine, raise a glass.
Good old Don, the guy who did all the movie voiceovers for like 30 years, just died.
Oh, was like today?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Today or yesterday or something like that. So, yeah.
Was it heart attack or how did he die?
So, I don't know. Something like
lung
that.
Lung cancer from smoking too much? Knows? Maybe? Who knows?
All I know is in a world without him, I'm vying for the job. So
there you go.
There you go. Absolutely.
All right, Chris.
How do I start? Well, there's kind of two points I want to make within this. The first point is I kind of think I start in essentially the wrong way. I'm not FTB 9000 compliant in the sense that I don't do necessarily a group template. I want to do that in a future upcoming campaign, but I usually start out with my own story. I build what the main event is, what I'm seeing I want to have happen, what the main thrust of things are going to be, and then I like then to throw the characters in there. Not necessarily, I think, really probably the wisest thing to do, but that's kind of always what I've done. I think I've sometimes allowed too much player freedom in character creation, in the sense that I let them make things from various areas where maybe they really shouldn't, and then I try and shoehorn them all together with various degrees of success, at least in the outset.
Where do you go for inspiration?
Like Chad had said, I do a lot of ripping off movies, you know, stories I've read. My last campaign, in certain themes anyway, was very heavily influenced by George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire, because that's what I was reading at the time. So
I thought for sure you were going to say Jar Jar Binks.
Jar Jar Binks is me so horny. no, but I that's what I was reading at the time. There was a lot of ideas in there that I liked in regards to how he treats knights and nobility and things like that. So my last campaign, which I would have to say is probably my most successful one, I pulled a lot from there. As far as inspiration. Other things, yeah, I do a lot of ripping off. Or sometimes my mind, you know, I mentioned this before a couple episodes ago, I do most of my thinking in pictures. And so I'll come up with what I visualize as being, this would be a really cool scene. I have no idea what's going on with it, but I like the idea of doing something like this. You know, whether I get that image from something I see or combining two elements I see or a song or something. And it kind of all comes together. And then I may build things around that to have that scene happen. The second point I want to make, I love and have always been a fan of the party meeting in the tavern, going to the local tavern. I know it's the biggest cliche in the book, but I love it. I have to always have that in any campaign that I do. I have to have that type of element in there because it just, for me, it is very cliche, but yet it gives me the opportunity to really do a very good job of stage setting. I can have some fun with that. I can describe the food and describe the aromas and really get into some of the detail. And I think it's very useful with new and even to a certain degree veteran players because it's an easy visual hook for them to key in on. Yes, it is cliche and they may kind of roll their eyes on there, but it's also familiar in that sense that it helps to kind of draw them into whatever groundwork I'm trying to lay.
How many notes do you keep? Like when you come to a table, what kind of preparation do you have with you?
I do a tremendous amount of preparation, actually. I'm more like you in the sense that I don't have exquisite amounts of notes, but when I write out my Uber plot, I write out the entire plot of what's going to happen. And then within there, I detail in a rough sense what's going to happen at this stage, at this stage, at this stage. And what I will do is I'll give those portions names. So I'll like describe details. The characters will travel to this land and they'll meet this person and have to rescue them from X. And this will be detailed in the adventure. And then I'll give the adventure a name and I bold that. So I know that I have to write an adventure called this that covers these details as I go through the campaign. Then when it comes to that, of course, then I will take that time to write out the adventure. And I don't know if it's the veteran in me, but I feel compelled to make sure that when I'm writing things out, I have as much detail as possible because I personally believe that gamers or players can smell something being made up. And so for me, if they can smell that, they're not necessarily going to pursue that. I'm a fan of sometimes throwing in misinformation or red herrings, not necessarily, you know, directly leading them to where they need to go. I like to give them the option to think that, well, maybe if we go this way, this is really what's supposed to happen, as opposed to if we go this way. I like to have a little bit of that variable in there. So even though I may be railroading them, it helps to kind of create an illusion that they're not necessarily being led along by their noses.
question for you, kind of along those lines. I sit here and listen to you talk. It seems like most of the examples you're using, meeting in the bar being the biggest one, seems to strongly imply a fantasy game. But I know that you run a lot more than fantasy. I mean, you, like me, have a huge background in Battletech. Do you run those games or prepare those games differently than you do fantasy games? Everyone pulling their mechs up to the green hamster end just doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So, by the way, that's on Solaris 7 in the Richard Gear District, if anyone's looking for it.
That was actually my favorite of the inns in the Battletech world. Oh, I love that place. Oh, the stories I have.
That's
all right. The tavern in the sci-fi setting to me works the same way, because you can meet the unscrupulous merchant who wants to hire your mercenary unit to travel to this world because he's heard of a lost tech cache that might be there. The same kind of merchant who wants you to jump across the clan border to raid this or free these people. You still have that same opportunity. Now, granted, I don't want to sit here and typecast myself saying that's the only thing I do. It's not. But it is a very practice cliche that, to me, it just doesn't get old. But I think it is translatable, you know, across genres.
What's the biggest weakness you have in your GMing style?
My biggest weakness is that I go in with the mistake that my players are just as knowledgeable or as into the campaign as I am.
Chris, I've got a question for you, and this just sort of goes to how you start your campaigns on a technical level. Do you like to start off with like first level characters, or what level do you like for your character or for your group to start off at?
I've always had issues with greens starting off, only because I think it doesn't make, at least from the way I approach things, it doesn't make sense that, you know, some noob from Village X is just going to show up and go on this grand adventure.
I personally prefer it that way, because I think that within, you look like a superhero story. You know, the superhero movie, especially if it's the first in the series, just never feels quite complete without the origin story.
Superman wins. Well, no.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember we've run D&D games in the past where we would start the characters off, and this was second edition, at level zero, where you were classless. You just were like a D4 hit die peasant. And we actually went through the process of, okay, how did you decide on this vocation? How did you convince somebody to teach you that? Or how did you get involved in learning that?
And the vocation of adventuring. Because adventuring is just another name for completely unemployed.
Yeah. Well, right, which is why. And then the games
I'm between
we ran
jobs
that,
right now.
Yeah, which is why in the games we ran that no one had the vocation of adventurer.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting for you to say that. Because like I said, to me, I think that low-level story is the most compelling. Because it's the part of the story in which you're the biggest underdog. You're really trying to find your way through.
You know what that means, Chris? That means you're wrong.
That's exactly what it does mean
I'm wrong. And I'm not saying that having that, you know, that origin story kind of thing is wrong. But I like starting players and characters to have a little bit of experience going in. So, I mean, like, for example, most of the time I'll start them off even just at second level. And I do that, because I like the idea of them having a little bit of backstory.
Not getting beat up by the weakest skeleton in the pack.
And that's the other thing too, you can have a little bit more excitement.
You can have a little bit more excitement when with a second level character. You can get away with a few more things to make it a bit more thrilling, especially
the
with
town
new
dog
players.
Doesn't mutilate you.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly.
What's that D&D
the
saying?
Comes up and gets you.
There are first level characters, but there's no such thing as a first level adventure.
Right, which I don't think.
That's more of a numbers thing.
Right, I would debate that point, but I think nonetheless the axiom holds true. That
especially in like D&D.
When you're walking around with 3 hit points and a mediocre roll from anything can kill you.
Tripping down the stairs. And, time to roll a new character.
Now with levelless systems, it kind of gets rid of that. Like Shadowrun's a perfect example. You can start out with a character, you know, just brand new guy, you just made up, no karma, he's just his stats and that's it, ready to go. But yet, it's implied for the skill levels he has and the attributes he has, or attributes, depending upon how you want to pronounce that, it is, he's got some history with him. So he's not necessarily wet behind the ears. But for me, it's just it's kind of a personal preference, and it gives me also the opportunity to have a little bit more flexibility in saying, okay, you gave me this great background information about your character. Here is the reason why they're here, and here's kind of what they did to get to this point, and now this is where we're going to pick up the action.
All right, and as we're going through this, everyone remember that we are also collecting your GM profiles if you're interested in sending them to us. As we've been saying, 5-minute max, put it in MP3 format, and send it to feartheboot@gmail.com. And I believe next week is going to be our last week of our GM profiles, where I'll be giving mine. So unless somebody new comes on the show or we grab a guest that we want to get that from, that'll be the end of it. And in the weeks thereafter, we will release a bonus episode of your guys' stuff.
One other point I really want to make, and I think this is where, you know, we talked about my weakness. I think this is really where my strength lies. I really work hard at making sure that each character has a real emotional investment in the plot that they're going into. That in some way, shape, or form, they're all intimately tied to the plot that's going on.
Your style sounds very, and I don't mean this as a put down. I hope nobody takes it, especially you, Chris. I hope nobody takes it this way. You sound like you have a very traditional style of GMing. You know, it's just like the story structure and running it through. And like I said, I don't mean that as old man.
Now that you mention that, I see what you're saying. That if you
and I'd have to agree with you.
And all the tropes and such of GMing.
Yeah.
Chris is very much the traditional GM, which is something that none of the rest of us are.
Right.
That, you know, even whether we're note heavy or improv or don't GM at all or whatever the case is, all of us, we try to kind of spin things a different way and get things to go in a different way. And
I have a feeling that a lot of people, when they respond to this in our episode review thread, I think a lot of people are going to come back and go, yeah, I mean, that no real outrageous, mind-blowing insight. That's pretty much how I run my game. You know, I think you'll give. And like I said, I mean, that sounds like I'm blowing off your style. I totally don't mean that at all. I mean, right. I think you are the norm.
And I don't take it that way, because I think that even within that, you know, quote-unquote traditional model, I think that there is still a tremendous amount of, you know, flexibility.
What we're going to start talking about today is something that we set up in last week's episode, which we mentioned it was coming. We are going to spend the next 3 episodes on a little bit of RPG evangelism, so to speak.
Spreading the word.
Yes, because this is a hobby, like all hobbies, that thrives on bringing people in. And you know what? Even that aside, it's just better when you've got more friends to play it with.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're going to do this episode is we are going to offer some tips for trying to get people who are not in the hobby to give it a try.
Yeah.
Whether they're just not interested, have never heard of it before, have some misconceptions, or they are outright hostile to the idea of RPGs.
Everyone from, hey, what is this RPG thing you're doing? To, you know, I don't want those books in my house.
Right. The next 2 episodes we are going to do, there's probably just going to be Chad and I, because we want to reduce the number of people on the mic because we're trying to educate, not debate. Fear the Boot normally thrives on debate and banter and humor.
Roundtable discussion, but different hosts, different opinions.
A horrible way to instruct anyone.
Yes.
It's a great way to take someone who already knows the subject and get them thinking deeper, but it's a horrible way to instruct a beginner. So in the next 2 shows, it's going to be a relatively small number of us, and we are going to do 2 things. Next episode, we are going to say, okay, you've never played an RPG before. So we're talking, not to our usual listeners, but we are talking.
These next 2 episodes are not for you. The people listening to Fear the Boot, I think the vast majority of them are role players or have role played. What this is that in this episode, you learn how to sell the game, quote unquote, to someone, and now they want to learn a little bit more. Will you burn this MP3 onto a CD for the next episode, and then you hand them the CD?
And we are going to be talking to non-gamers, trying to give them some sense of what this hobby is. The episode after that, so our 3rd episode, is going to be speaking to those people again, but now we're going to say, and some of you people listening to us might get something out of that episode, we're going to say, okay, you've decided to pick the hobby up. Where do you start?
Yeah.
How do you read die annotations? How do you find books? How do you find people? How do you avoid some of the really immediate problems that can crop up? So with no further ado, let's get into the topic at hand. Speaking now to our normal listeners and regular gamers, How do you sell role-playing games to someone who is not in the hobby? And let's start off with people who are
friendly,
unopinionated, or friendly. They're positive to neutral in disposition. They just don't get it.
I had this exact situation happen to me over Labor Day weekend. It totally unplanned, wasn't even trying to do it or whatever. My dad's wife is a very normal person. She's not geeky in any way. I don't even think she watches Star Trek or anything like that, you know, the mainstream sort of nerdiness. She's into sports. She likes to party. She plays sports and stuff. I mean, that sports is her big hobby, and fitness and women's magazines. And she is a very, very normal person, has a career and all this sort of stuff. Not to say that gamers don't have careers, but or play sports for that
usually
matter.
Women don't have careers, right?
Oh, yeah. But no, it's,
well, they have careers, but it involves making me a pie.
Yeah. But no, she is not a nerd in any way. She is totally non-geeky and does not understand this role-playing game concept. And, you know, she's interested in my life and stuff and what I do. And for the past couple of times, you know, I've tried to explain to her that, you know, I help do this podcast and, you know, I do this thing. You know, it's like they call me. It's like, hey, can you come over on Sunday? No, I can never, ever come over on Sunday. I do this thing every Sunday where we game. And this weekend we had our sort of Labor Day barbecue at her family's house. And I was talking about going to Gen Con, actually, and what Gen Con was. It was really big and exciting and stuff, and we had a really good time. And I was telling her, oh, yeah, and we did all this stuff through the podcast. And she was trying to understand, like, I was able to tell her what a podcast was, but she didn't understand what it was about. What the hell are we talking about every week? And she didn't know what a role-playing game was. And she's like, tell me what a role-playing game is. Explain this concept to me. I have no clue. So the first thing I thought is you have to do it. You have to explain it in terms they understand.
Right.
You cannot just say, oh, well, we Shadowrun. We just take a Shadowrun book and start playing.
We take our character sheets and our dice. Well, what's a character sheet?
Yeah, I take on a role of another character. Why would you do that? You don't do that in Monopoly. And, you know, I'm not a shoe in Monopoly. It's just a thing you mark down. And so,
I am a cannon in Monopoly, just FYI.
Well, yeah. I've heard that about you. So what
short fuse.
Wow. So what I did is I took from the standpoint of a campfire. It's like she's been camping before. Mm-hmm. And you know how around a campfire you tell a story, or someone tells a story, and it's a story about spooky woods and a, you know, there's a werewolf out there and this lone cabin and stuff. And she's like, yeah. And then imagine, though, I'm telling you this story, and you know how there's characters in the story? Well, imagine if every single person around the campfire controlled the character in my story. I could not tell them what their characters did or do. They can't tell me what happens in the story. And we come together and we tell the story together. And then so I start going through it. You know, it's like, imagine you're one of the campers. And then I set the scene. You know, it's the woods are lonely, dark, and deep. And there's, you know, you're running through it and you're trying to get through to the cabin, and the sun's coming down. The branches are brushing against your face. And I did a better job of it over the weekend than I'm doing here. And you could see she was kind of like getting into it because it was a story and she relayed that. And then I was like, so you see this cabin that you're trying to get to, and then you think you see something in the window, and then it goes away real quick, and you're not sure you saw it. What do you do?
And I think the big thing
she said
there,
that she'd run away.
Off the rails.
So I had the other characters grab her. Yeah.
But, you know, the thing you got right there, though, I mean, absolutely, is you have to start with terms that they understand. Get out of your world. And for some people, this is easier than others. And I don't want to play to a stereotype here.
Yes, you do.
But there is, many geeks are a bit socially awkward. Not all, by any stretch of the imagination. I've met some extremely, you know, well-spoken, well-reasoned people.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome, Pat. But, but you,
zing!
Think about that. Like, I can't tell you how many times going through school, I had a math teacher where he'd get up there and try and demonstrate something, we'd ask him to explain it, and my favorite way of describing it is, if I knew enough to understand your explanation, I wouldn't have had a question.
Right.
And I see that also with programming. I'll read a programming. I don't know how to do something in code, and I'll find help online. And it's written from someone who cannot step out of their own knowledge, kind of take on that moment of ignorance and explain it to somebody right. who's...
Tech manuals are notorious
yes,
for this.
Yeah. That you can't get somebody to explain it in a way that makes sense. And that's something you've got to remember, that you're dealing with people yeah. that at best know nothing about your hobby.
Now, and
at worst have all kinds of misconceptions yeah. about your
and
hobby.
I want to stress, like with my story that I told her, and when you sell the concept of gaming to somebody, the people you're explaining it to aren't stupid. You're not dumbing it down. You're
exactly.
You're explaining it using terms
right.
and a framework that they understand.
Right. They know books. They know movies. They yeah. know campfire stories. Depending on the person you're talking to, they might know board games. I'm not talking here the European board games. I'm talking like Monopoly.
Right.
If I was going to try and explain this to one of my two sisters, she's a big Milton Bradley style board game fanatic, I'd probably put down Monopoly board and say, why are we trying to buy all this property up?
Yeah.
But, you know, well, that's the goal of the game. Okay, fair enough. But for a moment, let's pretend that these are all little people. What the heck is motivating them?
Yeah.
When I get to the railroad, if I own these three railroads, why can't I just jump between them? And you start to kind of add that layer mm-hmm. of complexity where you ask questions that the rules in Monopoly were never designed to answer.
Right.
Similar story to how Chad did this. When I was dating a girl several years ago, and I was trying to explain to her what a role-playing game is, and I just accepted we have no common vocabulary. So I did something real similar to what you did. I said, well, what are you interested in? I don't remember what she said, but she gave me some setting or some genre. I said, okay, we'll start with that. Within the setting or genre, let's just say it was science fiction. I honestly don't sure. remember. So she says, I'm into science fiction. I'm like, okay, you're in your space station apartment one day. The buzz rings. What do you do? She opens the door, and let's say there's a guy there, and the guy says, you've got to get down because the boss is expecting you. So she says, okay, I'm going to try and run down and beat the deadline. And I say, okay, well, how do we know if you ran fast enough? Mm-hmm. You know, you can't tell me because that's not really fair. It's not fair for me just to right. tell you. So take out a quarter. And I'll be like, okay, I'm going to flip this. You call it in the air. If you call it right, you made it. If you call it wrong, you were too slow. And now you've introduced a decision maker, because that's mm-hmm. another big part of role-playing games is right. the random decision maker. And
I did the same thing with the cabin story. Because I got her up to the cabin, and she opened the door, and there were dead bodies in there, and she screamed, quote unquote, and then there was a werewolf there. She had a flashlight, and I'm like, what do you do? And she said, I hit the werewolf in the face with the flashlight. And I'm like, okay, well, here's the thing. You could just say you do that, and that's cool and all, but what if I'm the game master, I'm controlling the werewolf. What if I just say the werewolf takes a swipe at you and takes your head off, because he's a big, huge werewolf with right. claws and stuff. That's not very fun, is it? It's not very fair, because now your character's dead and you can't play anymore. And she's like, yeah, that wouldn't be very fun. So, you know, what we do is we have certain stats, and, you know, I did a quick mathematical example, right. quick algebra of, you know, stat, modifier, difficulty, roll, random number. And of course she quote unquote rolled over it and smashed the werewolf right in the face with her.
Right. The only thing you cannot do in this demonstration is paper, scissors, rock, because then you're LARPing.
Yeah.
And that's not true. A road we want to take these people down.
And that was something
that's for the fourth or fifth episode from now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's something that I was thinking.
It's like part of health class where you learn about STDs. This is
that was something I was thinking about too, with the example of when you get to the actual crunchy rules part. I know I have a reputation for being a storytelling type game master, very rules light and stuff. And so people are going to be like, well, of course he's going to sell the rules light thing to the new person. I really think you should. Do not play up the rules. Numbers can be scary, even to number people and stuff, and you're not selling a mathematical formula. You're selling a concept. Mm-hmm. And going into deep explanations about what a character sheet is, and what stats are, what modifiers are, what polyhedral dice are, yeah. and minis and maps and all that, really starts to go away to them.
Right.
From the mm-hmm. basic
exactly.
concept. You're not teaching them how to play. You're explaining a concept.
We're nerds. We love details.
Yes.
But heavens.
Yeah, the further you get away from something that's familiar to them, the quicker you'll lose them. And, you know, for me, what's always worked is you know, recalling something that they likely remembered from the past. Did you used to read Choose Your Own Adventure books? Do you remember those when you were a kid? Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember those. Well, it's very much like that. Okay, so you're this person. You're going down here, and you get these two options. You can do this or you can do this. Well, what if you wanted to do the third option that wasn't there? Well, in a role-playing game, you can do that. And then what happened? And then I go on to explain. I don't get into the level of detail per se that you did, Chad, or Dan, but I say, if you want to do that third option, there's rules that govern that. And it usually involves dice, and that's that random element that decides whether or not you really are able to succeed. And then we go on and we go on and we go on.
Yeah. I think you really have to read the person you're talking to, because when I was talking to my dad's wife, I got to that point to where there had to be some explanation of a mechanic, even in a slight way. And I read her in that she was getting the concept so that I didn't have to skim too much. I could actually tell her, you know, like I said, do the algebra of stat, modifier, difficulty, role, and just real quick. I knew that if I went on too much about it, I'd lose her. But that, like I said, that's going to be really something you have to do when you're talking to these people, is, are you losing them? Look at them when you're talking to them. And if their eyes are wandering, if they're not asking questions, if they're not into it, what you need to do is you need to lay on story, lay on like that description. This is what it's like. At least this is what I've found, because I've done this several times, actually, is that you lay them into a story and you try and draw them into it. And that really helps snap their attention back. Yeah.
Something else I would recommend, not 100% of the time, but most of the time, is leave your books on the shelf.
Yes,
because
and your character sheets and your goddamn character stories.
Yeah, well, that's a given. But even if you're dealing with someone who's really visually oriented, and you think that you could, like, for example, when I was trying to get a couple guys into BattleTech, I showed them one of the technical readouts, which is nothing, honestly. It's a book full of mech pictures, and that really got them interested. But in most cases, the thing you are more likely to do is overwhelm the person.
Yes,
because you stick a rule book in their face, or even worse, hey, you didn't like this one, look at this one. Oh, don't like that one, look at this one. You stick a stack of rule books in their face, and pretty soon they think this hobby is so opaque, so unapproachable, so complex, they're just overwhelmed, like, man, I'm glad you have fun.
It's like I said earlier, I think one of the most important concepts here is you are not teaching them how to play a role-playing game. You are selling a concept.
Yes, just the concept.
Well,
and they don't want to see 300 pages of rules. No, it's just going to disturb
them. Nobody
wants
to read that.
Except hero players.
The basic rule here is keep it simple, stupid.
Yes.
Yeah, because like I said, we're talking about total newbies here, you know? And so that's, along with what you guys were saying earlier, I think the important thing that, just sort of sum up what we've all been talking about, or what you all have been talking about, I've been listening to, is that you need to find common ground with the individual you're talking with. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be different for everybody you talk to.
You cannot sometimes have your stock story.
No, I mean, and that's the thing. We're not going to be able to sit here and tell them exactly this, and this is how you're going to do it. You've got to judge the situation,
right. Know
a little bit about that person, and find that common ground.
Like,
I love your campfire example. I was just thinking of a few. Like, I actually know a number of people that play all number of video games, but they're not role players.
Right.
Well, that's a great one there. I mean, I think that's a very easy one. It's like, oh, your favorite game is, well, I mean, World of Warcraft would be the easiest, but say something else that you play Halo. You love Halo. Well, go from Halo to role playing. Well, let's just do like a future combat game kind of a thing.
What if Master Chief did more than shoot?
Exactly.
And, you know, he does in the cutscenes.
How would you like to play Master Chief? But, you know, let's see what, you know.
Yeah.
Let's
do what would you have done in this situation?
Have you run a squad and whatever?
You know, the three, I can remember off the top of my head, I think I've done more than that. I know I've sold the concept more than this. The three times that I really remember selling the concept, one was to my uncle, who was big into Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a Western story, a shootout at high noon, and why were they there?
This story, I believe, was pre-Deadlands.
Yes.
Now,
It was, and then the other one I did, you know, my dad's wife in the woods and stuff, and because I really didn't want to do a sports analogy. And then a third one I did, little boys. There's these two little boys I ran into, and they were like, what's a role-playing game all about? Well, you know what I did? giant robots smashing each other. Bah, BattleTech, and what it's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, you get to smash buildings and stuff, and it made a cool world.
And I was actually going to bring that one up. I said, you, in keeping it simple, go to the very basics. I mean, most of us growing up played some form of Cowboys and Indians or Cops and Robbers. I mean, mm-hmm. at the very essence of it, that is what it is. And yeah. I mean, that's, there's common ground for that. Like mm-hmm. mainly for boys possibly, but yeah. you can say, hey, okay, well,
yeah, little girls played
when
house.
When you were 4 or 5 years old, you know, you played, you know, Cops and Robbers and you were shooting them up with your buddies. Well, back then it was just like, bang, bang, you're dead. Mm-hmm. Well, the difference is, like you were saying, is now it's the same kind of thing. You're all playing in that group, except now we have some way of some impartial way of determining, yeah. well, yeah, you actually did shoot him and now mm-hmm. he's dead or you missed, instead of just saying, no, yeah. I shot you. I hit you. You're dead.
You know,
so and that's, you know, I mean, again,
yeah.
simple. It's
totally,
and
totally.
You can build from there. But so that's,
I think so far we have keep it simple. You're selling a concept, not teaching them how to play. And then a third one, I would say that I'm kind of getting from different people's stories.
Our first one in there, stick with things they know.
Stick with common grounds. Another one I would say that I'm kind of getting from different stories here is draw them into it. Don't
tell them about it.
Don't monologue. You know, I'll go back to my cabin story since, you know, I'm wonderful and all. But I drew her into it. I looked at her. It's like, okay, and this is what I do. I sit at the table and then I say this and I describe it like I'm going to do it. I really lay it on thick. And then I look at her and I describe her character. And it's like, this is what your character's like. What do you do?
Right.
And don't let them just stare at you and go, oh, I don't know. No. You can make these decisions. You can do this. You can do this. You can do this. What do you do?
Okay. If I can make one quick point here also that I think matters in relation to this, this kind of goes back to Dan, to what your first point was. It's really a lot about you, how you look and how you conduct yourself outside of the discussion of role-playing games. If you come across as that really weird guy, or come across as that really, you know, just oddball at work or amongst this social circle, and then you try and make this sale, they're going to associate that game a little bit with you. And I don't mean this to sound very harsh, but
are you just trying to say straight out, don't be a fat beard?
It's not a fat beard, but it's...
I don't think the fat beard's the issue. I think it's don't be...
a disgusting
weird.
Slog?
No, weird. I don't think weird. Because here's the thing. I'm going to try and finish Chris's thought for him, just because I'm like that. But the only reason I'm going to do is this is me taking my moderator role, because you're kind of moving into portion two. Because portion one is people who have no concept of role-playing games.
Yeah.
Portion two here, we're not going to get people who are hostile just yet.
Yeah.
But these are people who have heard of role-playing games and have some negative impressions. My brother-in-law, Adam, is one of these people.
Mm-hmm.
He told me flat out that before he met me and really got a good understanding of what I did, his view of D&D players was a bunch of guys that weren't necessarily out worshiping the devil or killing each other in sewers, but they would sit around in the basement, acting real dorky, laughing in these high-pitched nasal voices. At mm-hmm. least one of them was wearing a cape and a Viking hat.
Oh, that never happens,
and,
though.
Well,
and they imagine themselves doing imaginary women.
Yes, exactly. That they take that skit from wherever it was with the "I attack the darkness" line.
Yeah,
and or they take
Summoner's Geeks
or Scared of Girls or one of those things, and we laugh at those stereotypes because, like all stereotypes, they're true somewhere, but. I hope that doesn't fit the majority of players. It certainly has not fit many players I have met. But to them, that's what we do. That's what we are. And I think, Chris, is that the kind of thing that you're getting at?
Yeah, and I'm not saying, you know, everybody should become a square peg in the square hole and conform. But there is a certain, just like you said, there is a certain societal expectation. And if you have that weird oddball behavior all the time, it's making you thus unapproachable for a lot of things. You're never going to be able to try and convince somebody or sell that game to them. You're just not going to be able to do it. You've got to have some, you know, quote unquote grasp in reality to be able to base off of, to actually hold their attention to sell them. So it has nothing to do with the fat beards or, you know, the BO or anything like that. I mean, that's, you know, there are plenty of people who aren't gamers who do step who smell horrible. So. But it's a behavior issue. If you don't present the proper behavior outside of selling it, you're never going to be able to get the opportunity.
I think one of the proper behaviors that people need to remember too is that if you're at work and there's a secretary that you've never talked to and she doesn't know your name, don't run up to her and say, "Hey, role playing games, blah 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 blah."
That's the creepy zone. That's once again dealing with these category two people, the people that haven't asked about it, don't know you role play,
don't care.
Get to know them first. Yes. Is because one of the things you're fighting against, as we keep saying, is these stereotypes, which may be unfair, may even be largely untrue, but nonetheless, they're there. They are your enemy. And if you walk up to someone out of the blue and just try to dump this stuff in their face, it ain't going to go over well. Mm-hmm. And don't do it.
So this brings up a question. I think I've got a tangent off here a little bit. So we're generally talking about people who, like my example with my dad's wife, she came to me and she asked me, what is a role-playing game? And we're generally talking about that. Your brother-in-law brought it up in conversation or came up in conversation. How do you sell to somebody who doesn't inquire about it? Like, let's say your mom. She doesn't care. She doesn't know. She's not into it. And she's never asked what a role-playing game is. But you really want to tell her. You want her involved in your life.
Well, but I guess, I'd have to ask what the driving motivation is there.
Because like your girlfriend? Or
does it say, you just don't. This leads...
with most people, there's something that first makes me think, I ought to tell them about role-playing games. Because I come to find out, they've never tried a role-playing game, but they're really into Star Trek or comic books. Or, you know, maybe this is someone like my brother-in-law, who he's not that big into role-playing games, but he loves writing. He's a very creative individual. And so I find these things, and that gives me an easy in to start talking about role-playing games. Let's take someone who's into comics. Have you ever thought about writing your own superhero?
Yeah.
What would he be like? What would he do? And right here, you can start getting into that interactive storytelling. Hey, some friends of mine and I were thinking about starting up a superhero game. Would you be interested in joining it and trying out your superhero idea, seeing how he does in a super group?
Mm-hmm. And I think you just answered the question. What would the desire be? And that was it. I think your desire would be to be finding new players. I mean, but taking your example and just saying, if I were to just say I was at work and I, you know, somebody I've worked with for a couple of years, all of a sudden I feel the desire to start talking about role playing. No, I don't. And I mean, I have personal stories about that just because it's funny as a gamer. It's almost like we're going along with what you're saying. It's almost like we are sort of closeted, sort of like you said, you keep to yourself because of the stereotypes and whatnot. So like for me, I met some of the guys that I'm role playing with right now because I worked with them, but we worked together for more than a year before we ever broached the subject or
before you
subject.
Before you came out of the closet to each other.
Something happened at work, some movie was out and we were talking about it and somebody got up the nerve to mention something about role playing and then it's like, oh my god, you role play too? And you know, right there, so all of a sudden
we were
all role players, but we never knew it. Because
do you think we have GameDAR?
Well, if we do,
then I'm off the radar because I'm totally shameless about gaming. I tell everybody that, one of my hobbies is role playing games. I'm on a gaming podcast.
Well, I've gotten better, and I think this kind of thing will help, but a lot of I have my role playing friends, the friends that are in the podcasting and the war machine, this, that, and the other. And then I have another set of friends that I have sort of told them that I game. I say I game. I don't say that I role play because gaming to me is just it's generic enough that it could mean whatever.
If I meet somebody new and they ask me, so what do you do on the weekends for fun? Play role-playing games.
I also do a
podcast in role-playing games. I'm a huge dork.
Chris, you've been trying for about 15 minutes to talk, so go ahead.
Well, no, I'm just saying that it does have, you know, this kind of goes into the whole gamer shame issue. If you're like Chad and myself, who don't have a problem with saying, yeah, I play role-playing games, then it's, you know, it's not a problem to then take that next step and to talk about it.
Yeah.
That situation
almost opens up itself when you're, like you said, when you're like us, when we're very vocal about it. These situations where you can sell role-playing open up themselves, but that's not true of everybody.
Now, we talked about just here talking to people that we think might be into it. Because I asked earlier,
just keep
what's the compulsion to tell someone about RPGs? The other one, and I think it was you, Pat, who mentioned this maybe briefly, was what if it's someone like a girlfriend, where you don't see any signs that they're a gamer, but this is someone who's a big part of your life. And so they kind of need to understand what it is you do.
And whatever you do, please don't create the disinterested girlfriend. Yeah.
Dragging them to the game is not the answer.
No.
Unless they're at least going to make like Rice Krispie treats or something. And then, but
yeah, there's nothing worse than having a game
everybody has found. Let it go. And here's what I mean by that. When you meet someone like that, they don't totally get what it is you do. It's not a venereal disease. You don't have to confess it on the first date. Okay. Just let it ride. Once again, my brother-in-law, Adam, will keep using him as an analogy because he's a great one. He does listen to the show. So, but he's
what a dork.
What a nerd.
I don't even listen to podcasts about role-playing games.
But anyways, you know, I never sat down with him and had the role-playing game talk. But I talked to him about
why. Two gamers
why.
Really love a book.
But they throw some dice around. Things get a little crazy.
They throw some dice and they smile at each other, and then suddenly there's another gamer there with them.
Whoa!
But as I but as I sat there and just talked about my life, being someone who plays role-playing games a lot, certain family events get moved around because of the time frame during which I'm gaming. I've got a relatively successful podcast about gaming. It kept coming up. And so over time, as he got to know me and saw that I wasn't some kind of freak sitting in my basement with fake elf ears and a black cloak.
Only on Thursdays.
Then, it's just the same way that
weekend for me, baby.
He's into geocaching. And so the same way that
what a nerd,
the same way that he started telling me about his geocaching hobby. Uh-huh. Eventually, I started telling him about role playing.
Those guys really are devil worshippers, by the way.
Oh, yeah. They follow the GPS route out into the middle of nowhere where they kill babies for safety.
Have you ever gone to that website, geocache.com?
Slain virgins.
The caching points make a pentagram.
Oh,
anywhere
totally.
You go, it makes a pentagram.
Oh, absolutely.
100%. All right. Third category of people.
Third category of people is podcasters named Chris who constantly get cut off this episode.
I know.
What do you do about them?
Well, it's been that works.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a two-edged sword because we've gone back and forth between a Chris Exter and Chris can't talk at all.
Yeah.
And this episode's going fairly long, which is why I'm speeding up. So I need to slow back down.
Yeah, you've talked the fastest I've ever heard you talk in this episode.
I know. You know what makes me do that?
Holy crap.
It's when I have a lot to cover.
I understand.
Shoot off ahead. All right. Third category of people. Take my Morgan Freeman advice here. This is it. But advice he always got was talk low and talk slow.
Ladies out there are just withering right now.
The bedroom
and
balls.
Francis.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, the third category of people, those that are outright hostile to the hobby. Those
have
that
you
think,
guys ever met?
Yes,
some, I have met one person.
I have
like
met
this.
Multiples.
You have more of a church life activity
that's
than I
exactly,
did.
Exactly.
So.
That's right.
I was sired by one. My dad is
really?
Absolutely completely. My dad's an older man.
Mm-hmm.
Just in general, and he's from that era, and he bought into the whole. That church thing of back when it first came out that, these people, they play D&D and some of them were, found dead in a sewer or they
and that story is totally untrue too.
I know all this crap, but it's my dad just looks at it as that. And he softened up a little bit on it, but he still sees it as a waste of time. I mean, God, you're an adult. You shouldn't be playing games.
My
games
mom has the exact same attitude. My mother is an atheist. And so it isn't a religious thing with her at all. And she is very much of that is a this anime you watch and the comic books you read and the video games you play and the role-playing games you play are things for children.
See, I've heard it all.
I don't know that you can respond to that because that's just such honest hypocrisy. Because here's people, like in the case of your mom, I can't throw back the obvious one of, well, wait a minute, you watch sports, which is an even more far more vacuous thing than our
my mother but paints. She does, and watches television.
Well, she also consumes a lot of pulp novels.
A pulp, trashy romance.
Yeah, exactly.
Novels, so.
And so it's kind of like, I have real trouble. Everyone.
This is a woman who told me I needed to broaden my reading horizons when I was a kid. I only used to read sci-fi.
Right.
And she only read trashy.
Exactly.
Trashy
and
romance.
See, everyone out there has trifles upon which they waste their time.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there's anything you can do with someone who is hypocritical in the literal sense of the word, meaning lacking criticality, cannot look at their own life and see the ways in which they trifle away time as well. And on that kind of person, I just shrug my shoulders and just kind of say, well, I guess the best thing you can do...
More gaming for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess the best thing you can really do is not counterattack.
Right.
But instead, try to explain to them how this is not a waste of time. When I was at Gen Con, I was following around, I think it was Don Dem from Pulp Gamer. I was following somebody around the dealer room and happened to bump into some guy he knew who runs a some kind of consulting business or something. I didn't catch exactly what he does, but he specifically focuses on gaming and education, where he goes from school, he goes around schools and he goes around libraries. And he doesn't just pitch gaming for the sake of pitching gaming. He's got criteria that games have to meet this and accomplish this and do this. Otherwise, he won't touch them. But once he has those games, he goes in and shows how these things teach math, social skills, sympathy, the ability to understand other viewpoints, all that kind of stuff. You know, it helps broaden imagination, teach imagery. And he that's what he does is he shows the educational virtues of a role-playing game. Educational virtues that many other hobbies don't have. Not to say that other hobbies are wrong or bad, but just once again, if we go on the offensive, all you do is just piss the person off. And so you're probably better off trying to say, well, wait a minute, role-playing games do have virtues. If I gave this book, throw the Shadowrun first edition book at him, maybe here's the time you should bring out a book. Can a child understand this?
Yeah.
Does this look like a kid's game to
but
you?
But then that turns in, like you said, it you don't attack
and you,
them.
And you don't want to make it a pissing contest either.
Then it turns in, see, that, while I see the fun in that, it isn't that, in the at the end of the day, you're not going to get them to play a role-playing game.
No.
You might prove them right, you might win the battle, you might leave them in tears, but they're not going to play a role-playing game.
No, absolutely not.
And I think you've gotten to
but would you say that they're a lost cause? Well, I mean... Maybe well, they're so. Not you've a gone, lost cause, but it's not well, up to you. You've
gone to the extreme in this
do.
Case, I think. Yeah. Now, the third, I mean, the extreme of this third category, the really hostile, I think it's just
you're a sadist,
it's a lost
people.
Cause.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's something that you agree. Should, my personally, I just avoid it with the real extremes because what are you going to, I mean, what are you going to, it's all, it's actually to me, I look at it, it's the same as talking politics with somebody with an opposing viewpoint.
Yeah. There was this great,
you're right. They think they're right. They're not going to change your mind. They're not going to change your mind.
There was this great study that was in the Associated Press headlines a couple years ago where all they were doing, they're hooking people up to, I don't know, EEGs or brain scans, whatever. Those things where you get the nice, cool, color-coded pictures of the brain as the various lobes fire and such. Mm-hmm. And what they found almost without fail was when they approached anyone with a political statement, the very first center of the brain to fire was not the rational part, it was the emotional part. Mm-hmm. That if you walk up to someone and say, abortion is blank, they are not going to respond. They might respond with logic eventually, but their first part of the brain to fire is the emotional one. They're either pleased because they agree or they're angry because, quote unquote, you're wrong.
Right.
And I agree with you that there are some people with politics, religion, role-playing games, anything under the sun, where you approach them, their first, middle, and final responses will be emotional prejudice, and there is nothing you can do.
So you guys are saying that if you encounter somebody who is thinks role-playing games are the tools of the devil, there's nothing anybody can do about it?
No. What I'm saying is if you meet someone who says role-playing games are tools of the devil, and you cannot reason with the person.
Oh, they are not
a reasonable person. Yeah. That all you're getting is that emotional part of the brain firing again.
So if you come up to somebody who says,
again,
I understand that role-playing games are the tools of the devil. You play this game and I don't trust that. You know, it's like, but can you explain yourself?
Yes, I think,
if they're willing to open a dialogue.
Absolutely. And
then I would say they're probably not part of the hostile group, though, because...
Well, they could be. They could be hostile, reasonable. Yeah. And I've met people like that.
I think it's a matter of education, too. Look, I think it's a matter of people were educated to believe their first contact with role-playing games is somebody yelling that it's the tool of the
devil. Absolutely. I would use members of my own family for this. Mm-hmm. Growing up, I had this kind of response from my mother, that she was originally very, very hostile towards role-playing games. But... over time, over the years, she has largely softened up to it because first it was, okay, we're not going to play D&D, we'll play Star Trek, because it's science fiction.
Obviously, no magic in Star Trek, you know.
Start the closest you get is some of the psionics, but it's generally, it's not a threatening sort of game, religiously, morally, whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so that kind of softened it up. And then as the years goes by, you know, she sees me grow into a successful adult with a well-managed social life and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, this is kind of starting to get through to her that, okay, you know, maybe it's not so bad. And so I put her in that category. She was a very hostile individual towards this stuff. I was the kind of kid where I had to hide my D&D books between the mattress and box springs.
Yep.
And that's not a figure of speech. I mean, that's literally what I had to do.
I didn't have any room there. There was
too many other reading material.
Guns and porno mags. But, you know, so I think, yeah, and there are, if you get someone like that, I think what you have to do is be slow and patient, because if you engage the person in an argument, if you throw the book at them, like I was saying earlier, Chad, you're absolutely right.
You're going to win the day.
Yes, you're going to win the argument and lose the person.
But you're talking literally years worth of work there.
Possibly years.
The hostile class, you're not going to win them over in a day or a week. It's going to be a significant amount of effort invested in it.
Be educated yourself.
Just so you know,
you know, understand what their objections are and be educated yourself. I don't have references for a lot of these, but over the years, tons of people within the role-playing industry have gone through all the common objections to role-playing games and have, in some cases, put together some very well-researched and sourced documents debunking
One of them, Christian Gamers Guild.
Yes, Christian Gamers Guild.
A fantastic FAQ on this very subject. And they also have like a list, people in the role-playing game industry who profess to be religious or Christian.
Right.
And it's this long list of like 50, 60 people.
And and they've got an FAQ where they go through.
Oh my God, Gary Gygax went to church.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's obviously satanic.
But they go through the common objections of, aren't these things demonic? Well, no, and here's why not. And give very reasoned, and in some cases, well-sourced answers on why not.
Oh my God, Chris wants to speak. Speak, right, young Chris.
Open the doors to Iowa.
No, just related to that, there was, I think it was the CARPG, Committee for the Advancement of Role-Playing Games, I believe it was called, and that was the big organization back when I was younger, back in my day. But they, you know, they were the ones who were, you know, actively fighting and trying to go against that hostile group and portray it, portray RPGs in the positive light that they deserve. And I don't know if they exist anymore, but I'm sure that their resources, you know, are online, and there's plenty of online resources where you can find things to counteract all those common misconceptions of games.
So, and I think we covered quite a bit of ground here tonight, this is going to be a fun one for you to edit, Dan.
Oh, yes. We've got 90 minutes of material, which I need to bring closer to an hour, and somewhere in the middle of that, Chris's recording crashed.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What this means is my GMing style is going to be reduced to me saying, I'm a traditional game master.
I think that maybe what we should do, this is all behind the scenes stuff. So, one thing that, you know, we kind of paused there for a second, and we talked about it. It's like, okay, do we have anything else? We're going kind of long. I just want to, in this, on one note, I want to look back at talking to people who are interested or that you can get interested. I want to look back. What did we learn? What are some tips that you can take with you when you go and do this? What is the most important thing that we talked about that we learned?
Be patient.
Keeping it simple.
Speak their language.
Mm-hmm. You approach them. You put it in a framework that they understand and can relate with.
Do not overwhelm them.
You are selling a concept. You are not teaching them how to game.
Be sympathetic to whatever concerns they have. Yes. If you're trying to win them over and not win a debate, then be sympathetic to whatever concerns they have and take the time to show them they aren't true.
Yes.
Which may require more showing than doing.
Yeah. And, you know, just to reemphasize that, you can win the war. You can defeat your opponent and leave them in a smoking ruin. And they will never touch role-playing games ever again. And I think another thing, you want to have empathy with the person you're talking to. You want to look at them, and if you're kind of doing your sales pitch and you're drawing them into the game and you're drawing them into your explanation, let them talk, let them take part. You know, use an example of role-playing game where they are the character and you ask them, what do you do? And you kind of lead them on that path and see if they're getting bored and look, just look at them, look at what they're doing. Are they looking at you? Are they talking to you? Is it an interaction back and forth? You're not making a speech. You're not doing a monologue. You want to interact with them. You want to draw them in.
It's also not confessional in nature. You don't have to tell everyone, and you don't have to blurt it out in some Tourette's-like way upon your very first meeting.
Leave that to crazy people like Chris and I, who just have no public pride at all. So.
Absolutely.
Alrighty then, just a reminder to you guys that next episode
is not for you. Well, listen to it anyway.
It is for you to put on CD.
Yes.
Or put on your MP3 player and pass around. We are going to start the episode off from the very first word, talking to people that have never played a game before. So if things sound really strange in that show, I'm just warning you now that it's going to be a different format.
Yeah. Fear the Boot will become Don't Fear the Boot next week.
Alrighty, so I'm going to go spend the next 6 hours trying to edit this episode into workable format. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch your CD burners next time.
See ya.
Later. Bye. Days.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2008, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.